Before I announce the long-awaited outcome of the prizes, I would like to take this moment just to thank, first of all, the students for a fantastic set of posters. I know you've put a lot of effort into them. That reflected really well in the ease with which we can go around and look at them and hear your descriptions of the work. So congratulations to you all, and thank you very much for spending the afternoon to share what is clearly an impressive wealth and breadth of work that's ongoing in the department. It really is fantastic, I think, for us all just to come here and celebrate all the amazing work that you guys are doing. So thank you very much for that. I'd also like to thank the admin team, particularly Tom and Nikki and Ben and Jacqueline and everybody else who's been involved behind the scenes in making sure that the students have turned up with their posters, and that we have some nice drinks afterwards, and all the lovely paperwork that you see before you. So thank you very much to them for all the work. So we're going to start, first of all, with the poster prizes, and it is my pleasure to announce the winner for year one. And forgive me, we have a lot of, it's a wonderfully international department, so please, I'm going to say right at the start, if I don't pronounce your name correctly, please blame Brexit. So the first prize is going to Paula Ropinac for, and I haven't got my glasses, so forgive me here, elucidating the link between cell division, neuronal differentiation, and elliptogenesis in a human stem cell model of tuberous sclerosis complex. So, Paula, are you here? A winner. Of course, you're all winners. The work is fantastic. But we do have to pick one. We do have to pick one. Okay, so moving to year three. Sadly, our final year students. And again, farewell to you next year as you rise up, or this year. So it's been a joy to have you all, and we hope that many of you can stay on with us. But we are going to give the third year prize winner to Arvind Ganesh for clinical and health economic outcomes in thrombectomy eligible ischemic strokes. So that concludes that part for the poster winners. We now move on to the various prizes that you saw we were announcing over the past couple of months in the newsletter, and we've changed the model a little bit this year in terms of what types of prizes. We've included some new ones. And what we've asked the winners of the early career and the intermediate career rewards to do is to come and give a 5-minute presentation of actually what their paper was about. So as you know, for our early career research prize, this is for the best paper that was published in 2016, so it had to be published in that period of time. And again, I'd like to thank the committee who looked at the number of applications. It was a great turnout, actually, so thank you to all those who submitted applications. We, of course, wanted to give everybody a prize, but we can't, so we had to pick one. So what we've got is a runner-up for this prize, and this is going to Helen Barron for her wonderful paper in Neuron that is unmasking latent inhibitory connections in human cortex to reveal dormant cortical memories. This is work she's done under the excellent supervision of Tim Berry. So Helen, I'm not sure, are you here? You are here, Helen, come on. And the winner for our early career one is going to Zoe Alexopoulou for a beautiful paper published in PNAS D, ubiquinitase, USP8 regulates, alpha-synuclein clearance modifies its toxicity in Lewy body disease. And this is work she does under the supervision and mentorship of George Tafaris. So Zoe, if you wouldn't mind coming up to the stage, and I think the format is you're going to present. This will all magically work. There we go.
Okay.
So you're off.
Hello. Thanks a lot for listening. So the neuropathological hallmark of Parkinson's disease are ubiquinated Lewy bodies in substantia nigra, and they also contain aggregated alpha-synuclein. And the levels of alpha-synuclein have been causatively linked with the onset and pathogenesis of Parkinson's disease. So if we find a way to lower the levels of alpha-synuclein, then we can intervene in the pathogenesis of Parkinson's, which is very important. So what we started doing is we started to look if there are any differences in ubiquitination in Lewy bodies in substantia nigra versus cortical Lewy bodies. And the substantia nigra has more selective vulnerability to Parkinson's disease. And we found that Lewy bodies in the substantia nigra were less ubiquitinated than Lewy bodies in the cortex, and specifically less K63 ubiquitinated. So there must be some differential activation or expression of ubiquitin interactors. And a targeted screen revealed that the deubiquitinating enzyme USPA was upregulated in the substantia nigra brains from Parkinson's disease patients versus the cortex. It also co-localizes with alpha-synuclein, and more importantly, it's inversely correlated with the extent of ubiquitination and K63 ubiquitination. So we thought that USPA could be involved in the pathogenesis of Parkinson's, and we investigated it further. So in vitro, we found that USPA co-localizes with alpha-synuclein, and this suggests a structural interaction. And we also found that it deubiquitinates alpha-synuclein, and with specific preference to K63 chains, which suggests a functional interaction. But what about if it affects the level of alpha-synuclein? So USP8, when we overexpress it, we see that it increases the half-life of alpha-synuclein, and also when we knock it down in lentivirally, it decreases the alpha-synuclein levels by 35%. Quite substantially. Here we see that it does that through the lysosomal pathway, because we see an increase in the lysosomal flux, and by that way it also increases the clearance of alpha-synuclein. So in vivo, we know that when alpha-synuclein is expressed in the fly eye, it causes a rough eye phenotype, which completely was rescued with the concomitant USP8 knockdown. That wasn't due to decreased alpha-synuclein expression, because qPCR showed that the mRNA levels were not decreased, and immunoblotting showed that the protein levels were decreased. Thus, we know that it's due to increased clearance of alpha-synuclein. When we express alpha-synuclein in the dopaminergic neurons of the flies, we have an age-dependent locomotive defect and also loss of dopaminergic neurons, and these were both rescued by the concomitant knockdown of USPA. So we see that there is protection against alpha-synuclein toxicity in vivo in the Drosophila model. So far we've seen that USP8 overexpression actually deubiquinates alpha-synuclein and prevents its breakdown through the endosomal lysosomal pathway. So this, in our proposed model, can act in contrast to NED4, which we know that it actually ubiquinates alpha-synuclein and enhances its breakdown and also confers toxicity in vivo. So we thought that by targeting USP8, so to inhibit USPA, would be a target for disease-modifying therapies in Parkinson's disease, and it remains to be seen if specific inhibitors can actually replicate the findings in vitro and in vivo. Thank you very much, and I would like to thank my supervisor very much, Dr. Faris.
Thank you.
So moving on now to our intermediate career research prize. We have joint runners-up for this one, and it's jointly going to Charlie Stagg for her paper in Science Translational Medicine, Ipsilesional Anodal TDCS Enhances the Functional Benefits of Rehabilitation in Patients After Stroke, and to Andreas Themistocleous for the Pain and Neuropathy Study, PINS, a cross-sectional observational study determining the somatosensory phenotype of painful and painless diabetic neuropathy, and that was published in Pain. So I know that Andreas is not here, but Charlie, are you around? There we are. Charlie, come to the stage. And and the winner is Saad Jabadi, who had a beautiful paper in Science last year, Task-Free MRI Predicts Individual Differences in Brain Activity During Task Performance. Saad is away at Carla Miller's physics retreat, so he can't be here today, but Yue has kindly stepped in and on Saad's behalf will deliver his lecture. And I've been reminded that I've not given the poster prizes their actual prizes, which are some book tokens. So I'll make sure I see you afterwards at the drinks and you'll actually get your prize. Great, so Yue, please come to the stage. Thanks so much for doing this.
Hello, I'm not Saad, so I couldn't be here, so he asked me to present his slides. So Saad won for this paper, which is about predicting the variation we see in individual subjects in task fMRI. And asking if we can predict those differences that we see from connectivity features that we get from resting fMRI. So the basic idea that we pursued was we took pairs of resting scans and task scans from subjects in the HCP, and we built a machine learning model to predict the task contrasts from the resting features. And the key point that Saad wants to emphasize here, I think, is that you can predict multiple tasks from one resting scan. And here's an example of the results that we got. So what you're seeing here are four different quadrants for four different tasks out of seven different task domains that we had in the HCP. The bottom right, for instance, is a motor task where subjects were asked to wiggle their left or their right foot. And you can see the contrast is more wiggle for left versus wiggle for right. And you can see that because in the top row, it's the medial surface of the right hemisphere, the foot area. And you can see the three columns are different subjects. So in the middle row, we're seeing a zoomed in view of the actual task contrast, and those vary between subjects, so there's difference. And that's what we wanted to predict. And in the bottom row, it's the prediction. So that's what we predicted with our model from the subject's resting data. So we trained models on other subjects' rest and task, but in this, for each subject, we never saw that subject's task data, so we were blind to it, and we just had the rest data in the model, and then we predicted. And you can see there's variation in the predictions, so the bottom row, the different columns are different, but I hope you think that there's a good correspondence within the columns, so within subject, there's a pretty good match. And that's basically what we found for all of the different tasks, well, all but one. There was one task we didn't do so well on because we probably need subcortical regions and we only use the cortical activation. So we didn't have the activation, but for most tasks, and for all the tasks I'm showing you here, it works pretty well. And you can see that there's a language task in the top right, a theory of mind task, and then there's a spatial relationship task. And in each case, there's variation between subjects and we can predict it from the resting connectivity. So, why is that useful? A few things you might want to do with that. Here we've done looked at laterality indices. Each bar on the left is the laterality index. So how dominant is the subject for language in the left versus the right hemisphere? So below the line are people who are left dominant. So that's most people. And to the far right of that plot, you see a few people are dominant for the right hemisphere. And the blue there are the actual scores and the reds are the predicted. So maybe more useful is in pre-surgical mapping. So this is an important use case that we've pursued in follow-up work. where we took clinical data from Natalie Voots and the surgical team, where the subjects did a language localizing task, so they named as many fruits and vegetables and stuff as they could in a few minutes, and they got resting scanned as well. And we predicted for them their language activations. And this is important because, well, first of all, there's more variation in patients, partly because you might get a big old tumor in your brain, pushing away where you might normally have activation, and also because they want to scan subjects before surgery so that they can find out where the language areas are so that they can plan their surgery accordingly. So we did that. The little cartoon on the bottom is trying to make the point that we had some controls in this study as well, so we built a model that was trained only on controls, and then without ever training on patients, we predicted on the patients, and we were able to transfer the models that were trained only on controls into patients, and that might be useful, for instance, if you wanted to add new tasks. You don't have to make your patients do any tasks at all, so I should say, some patients might not be able to perform a task in scanner, so you might just stick them in the scanner and give them a resting scan. And also, surgeons might want to use, if you had access to multiple task contrasts without any extra burden on your patients, you might want to use this so that you can get all that information and make a better informed decision. So before this, we can recommend this for clinical use. It needs further testing. We do some direct cortical stimulation studies and whatnot. And we're hoping in the future to include this in a release of FSL under the name of Localize. Thanks.
Pass it on to Sarah. That's wonderful. Thank you so much. So we're now moving on to our next set of awards, and the next one goes for excellence. And this is an award given to members or member of the department who's really gone over and beyond the normal everyday duties. And it is my great pleasure to announce that this year's winners are the two radiographers from FIMRIB, Mike Sanders and John Campbell. They are our senior radiographers who have been unbelievable in what they've done for FIMRIB in terms of overhauling all our procedures, making sure that we have robust, quality, safe methods and protocols, training for all the hundreds of different experimenters that come in and want to go into the scanner with bits of metal in them, and these guys are the safeguard for all that. But beyond all that, they've been really crucial in, again, trying to develop a new continuous professional development course so that radiographers themselves, in terms of their own career and professional development, that within the team that they oversee and look after, that there is an opportunity for their career progression to occur. And it's something we haven't been doing at FIMRIB, and they've taken that forward so that, again, it's a really impressive program to enable their professional development. They've embraced and delivered for us some really quite challenging advanced imaging protocols, obviously not just including our 7-Tesla machine, but some of the more advanced physics developments that we're very fortunate to have at FIMRIB. These are not easy things, and these are not easy protocols that one would ordinarily use in a regular radiography service. And these guys have been fantastic at embracing and taking on the challenge of working with the physicists to make them deliver for us as applications people so that we can have the benefit of that. And not only have they done that, but they've also been fantastic in helping our dear colleagues at psychiatry, where, as you know, we put in a 3-Tesla MRI last year. They've been crucial in actually helping just get that whole project and that whole lab up and going, and again, making sure that the service delivery there and the training of the radiographers is, again, held to the same standard as we have at FIMRIB. So for all that, we think that their work has been absolutely excellent, and it is my delight to award you this year's Award for Excellence. So come on up. Great, and the next award is the award for outreach, and this is going to, and I don't think I'm going to say this right, Yulia Blesniak, and she is a researcher working with Dave Bennett's group, and she was critical for really the success of the Brain Diaries and put a huge amount of effort in, alongside, I know, the neural injury group of Dave's, who also worked very hard on this, but We want to thank you for the effort you put into the Brain Diaries. This is just a photo of some of the children enjoying learning about their senses, both from a normal touch and a painful touch perspective. So earlier we want to recognise that extra effort you went to for outreach and what you've done, hopefully, in exciting young people of the future to become neuroscientists. So thank you very much. And the final award, before we move on to the main event of the day, is a new one that we decided we'd do this year. Because teaching is such an important part of any academic department, as I keep stressing to you whenever I give talks, it really is obviously one of our core things that we have to do as a department, and it's something that we're very, very proud of. And so we thought we really should recognise the teaching, not only the teaching we have to do in terms of the undergraduate clinical teaching across the areas of anaesthetics, neurology and ophthalmology, but of course all the other teaching we're doing for our graduates. Whether that's the new MSc course, whether it's the wonderful simulation work that the OCSTAR team do, whether it is the FIMA graduate course, there are just so many growing areas of teaching that we're now doing. And as you know, we formed a new teaching committee so that we can really learn from all these different areas of teaching what's working and what isn't working and take that forward. So actually, this was a really hard one because all those areas really deserve a prize, because for 5 years we've not been able to, or we've not had an award for them. And so, you know, we really found this very, very difficult, but we had to pick one. And so what we decided we'd do is we're just going to sort of go through a category, because it really is apples and pears, because the type of teaching is very different, one can't compare. So this is no reflection on the others that have not technically won. It's just that this year we decided we'd recognise a team that have taken something that was not, to be quite frank, working very well, and that the clinical students were pretty unhappy with in the context of the neurology teaching. And we put Gabe and his merry band of team behind really trying to turn this around. And Gabe DeLuca, alongside Tim Lawrence, Simon Rinaldi, Vicky Anderson, Jan Dandridge, so again, the clinical team as well as the administrative team, have worked their socks off to turn around the delivery of that teaching. And it is now scoring top marks, we're getting fantastic feedback, and the medical school are absolutely thrilled. So I think they deserve the recognition this year for the teaching award, and I'd like you to come down, all of you, and receive your certificates and your prize. So let's acknowledge Tim Lawrence, Simon Rinaldi. We can move to the main event. So it gives me such pleasure, and it is a huge honour, to introduce our fifth annual Thomas Willis Lecturer, Professor Alan Bassbaum, who is Professor and Chair of the Department of Anatomy at the University of California, San Francisco. It's a particular delight because Alan is not only someone who I admire and respect as an absolutely brilliant pain scientist, but he's also a dear friend. He's a wonderful storyteller, and is a constant source of hilarious jokes. Sometimes they run a little close to the wind, a little naughty, I have to say. And you'll often find Alan at any congress or meeting with a horde of people around listening to his wonderful tales. So do get him going over a drink later on. He's a native of Canada. He did his first degree actually in psychology at McGill University, working with Ron Melzack. So those from Painfield will know he's sort of one of the great originators of pain and thinking about pain, particularly putting the brain at the centre of pain. And he then moved on to the University of Pennsylvania, where he did his PhD, and that's when he moved more into sort of mainstream cellular biology and the spinal cord. He then came to UCL in London and worked with Pat Wall, again, another great sort of old grandfather of the pain field, and the great textbook of pain is Melzack and Wall's book. So he worked with Pat Wall at UCL. He's told me not to give any dates, so I'm giving you the chronology, but without any actual detail of the dates this all happened. But he had an enjoyable time as a postdoc at some point in the past in London with Pat Wall. And then he moved to UCSF, where he did a postdoc with Howard Fields, again, another wonderful pain neurologist. And that's where he became tenured and has spent the majority of his academic career. There are too many landmark discoveries to list, from the discovery of on and off cells in the brainstem that control descending inhibitory and facilitation pathways. That's work he did with Howard Fields, and that certainly has formed the basis and been the inspiration for a lot of my group's work, defining, looking at neuroimaging to look at those same systems. So he's gone from that work, he's gone back out into the periphery, into the spinal cord, the molecular basis of nociception, and his laboratory currently now is examining the mechanisms through which tissue and nerve injury produce changes in the peripheral and central nervous system, resulting in persistent pain. And also in parallel, he's getting really interested in the circuits that underpin itch, which is a much underexplored area. He's additionally a great citizen and was from 2003 to 2012 the editor-in-chief of Pain, which is the journal of the International Association for the Study of Pain. He made it into now the leading journal in our field and was a fantastic editor, always a very wise judge of papers and very skilled in handling argumentative authors. There are too many prizes and awards to list, but notably he is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and he was made a fellow of the Royal Society. He's been a mentor, and still is, to many, many people who are all absolutely devoted to him. He is brilliant, creative, he's willing to engage with the complex problem of pain from a molecular through to systems perspective. He's always willing to learn, harness new technologies and ideas, and always willing to argue and challenge the status quo. He is truly an inspiration to us all, and I'm so very grateful he's taken time out of a madly busy schedule to visit us with his lovely wife, Marcia, and give us the fifth Thomas Willis lecture. So, Alan, please come to the stage, and we look forward to hearing your lecture. I will present the prize now, and then afterwards I've asked Dave to give the vote of thanks, and I think we're going to break the tradition, and if it's all right with you, Alan, we will have some questions, if that's okay. So can we please acknowledge and thank Alan? It can be broken very easily. Beautiful nameplate that has the inscription to note the date and the things, and we can ship that to you, Alan. And then there's a little something extra. Alan's very keen, and his wife on scholarly works in history. So we took a dash out and had a private tour of the Western Library and the Bodleian Library this afternoon. So what I have you also here is, if any of you haven't seen this, this is a book done by the Bodleian librarian, Richard Ovington, and it's called Marks of Genius. And what it does is it will encourage you to come back, because it highlights in here the works that are, again, incredible works spanning arts and humanities that are pinpoint works of genius that people have done throughout the ages, and we have then the collections of these in our Bodleian library. So this is a summary of those to lure you back to Oxford sometime. So now I think we just need to switch to the Mac. You are great. And should we dim the lights?
Well, Irene, that was quite an introduction. And much appreciated. It's been a fabulous day meeting people, getting to know Oxford. When I lived in London, long time ago, I did visit Oxford, but I really, this time Irene gave me a little inside tour, and it was very special. You have no idea how lucky you all are. When you live in a city that was basically destroyed in 1906 and started all over again, it's a little bit different from Oxford. So I'm happy to talk here, and particularly pleased, and you'll see why, to be giving the Thomas Willis lecture. I'm the chair of the anatomy department. There are very few departments in the world left that are called the anatomy department. I learned that even here you change the name, and they pretty much change them in every, I think where there's only two left in the United States, but the young faculty said they love to give their card out. It says anatomy. It says, you have dead bodies in your department? So sure, we have dead bodies in our department. So we kept the name anatomy, and it really fits with Thomas Willis. And I decided to do a little bit of history checking, because I wanted to learn a little bit. I mean, of course, I knew about the circle of Willis. I teach neuroanatomy, I don't teach gross anatomy, but so I did a little reading. And of course, I'm well aware, this is a picture of Thomas Willis, and his book is in the Bodley Library. And this was his introduction, where he actually established, it says, the concept of neurology. He was a colleague of Christopher Wren quite a while ago, and basically put anatomy on the map. But what is very interesting is what gave him a reputation. Now, these days, when you're a scientist, you get a reputation when you publish a paper in Nature or some other journal of that repute. It was a little bit different back in those days. And what I learned is a lot of it came about because of this. This picture is in the Bodley as well. There was a woman, Anne Green, who was executed many years ago, 17th century, for apparently she killed one of her children. I didn't read all the history on that. It was pretty rough. And it was Thomas Willis's habit with his colleague to take executed individuals as one way to get bodies so that they would be able to dissect them. And so, but I just captured a few points. And it said his fortunes as a clinician changed in 1650 when he actually revived a prisoner named Anne Green. Now, what was pretty remarkable about that is that she hung for half an hour and was pronounced dead and was placed into a coffin. Then he and his partner went and took the body down, planned to dissect it. They opened the coffin and started to dissect, and she started making noises. And so that was his claim to fame, and it really was a claim to fame. And this is such so British, I love it. It says, after this incident, Willis' medical practice took off. His life became more comfortable. So you may have a harder time replicating his work in order to get claim to fame. But so he also did lots of other wonderful things. But Irene, thank you for this real tribute and honor. What I want to talk about is very different from, in some ways, what I am going to try to do is revive the spinal cord. So maybe there is some metaphor there or analogy. I was asked to come up with a title, and you'll see why I talked about an approach to treating what I call the disease of chronic pain. So the textbooks, and I'm sure the medical students and nursing students and dental students, this is what most of them are taught. It's rather straightforward that pain is simple. You basically have an injury, a noxious or painful stimulus that activates a subset of afferent fibers, nociceptors. The information comes into the spinal cord, it goes up to the brain, and poof, you get pain. It's pretty simple, that's what the textbooks say. In some respects, it's correct. It's great if you want to study acute pain, but acute pain to the clinicians is not a real big deal. It goes away, and patients only come back when it doesn't go away. And what we're really interested in is not so much in what causes acute pain, but problems such as the following. This is one of the classic neuropathic pain conditions. So you can divide chronic pain conditions into largely inflammatory pains, tissue injury, as opposed to neuropathic pains, which result from damage to the nervous system itself, the great majority being in the peripheral nervous system, but also after spinal cord injury, post-stroke, or even in multiple sclerosis. This is an individual who may have had a minor nerve injury, and you can see there's obviously redness, there's autonomic change, there's even a dystonic condition, but what is striking about this is there's ongoing burning pain and there's incredible hypersensitivity, and those are the real major features that pretty much make these patients, make their life miserable. And they're very difficult to treat, we'll talk about that. It was illustrated, one of the, that first slide I showed with all those covers, you're right, being editor-in-chief of the journal is not fun. Because if you accept the paper, it's because the paper was so wonderful, at least that's what the author tells you, and if you reject the paper, then you're a fool. But once in a while, what we did do is I got to pick the covers of the journal, and that actually was the best part. And this was one of my favorites. This is a sculpture made by an individual who has complex regional pain syndrome, and he was trying to illustrate this is what a patient with chronic pain experiences. You cannot see their pain, and that's what makes pain, on the one hand, so difficult, but on the other hand, so interesting to study, and that's what I'm interested in. And obviously, I don't have to describe now what this individual is experiencing. It's pretty clear. So What do we know about neuropathic pain? I could give you a lecture that will go on for hours, but I want to highlight what I believe is the major contributor and then an approach to management. In my mind, there's no question that the most important contributor, and in some respects I'd say a necessary contributor, is actually afferent activity. So when you have nerve damage, what I've illustrated here is it's half of the spinal cord. I just put a single afferent fiber coming in, the leg would be out here. Here's the gray matter of the spinal cord. And when there's nerve damage, the patient could end up with a neuropathic pain condition, postherpetic neuralgia, even phantom limb pain, complex regional pain syndrome. But unquestionably, if you inject local anesthetic at the site of the injury, I'd say close to 100% of patients, the pain will go away. So that says for sure that there's an absolute contributor drive from the injury site. So when there's peripheral nerve damage, there's hyperactivity, and many people have studied the nature of this. It drives input into the spinal cord, and then the brain interprets that, and you end up with pain. But it's an essential contributor. But it's not the only contributor, because what happens in the case of neuropathic pain is that the central nervous system changes. And this is what I mean when I use the term the disease of neuropathic pain. I don't know that that's the case for other pain conditions, but in neuropathic pain injury conditions, the only manifestation in many of these individuals is pain. So the disease is this reorganization of the central nervous system that now exacerbates the abnormal input that comes from this injury site, and you're left with this horrific condition. So what drives those changes? Well, without question, one of the major drivers is an NMDA receptor-mediated sensitization. What do I mean by that? I'm sure all of you know about the NMDA receptor. It's a glutamate receptor that gates calcium and produces long-term changes in the activity of CNS neurons. So here's our diagram, a little more complicated now. Here's the afferent fiber. It's a C fiber, no susceptor. They're all glutamatergic. All afferents are glutamatergic. When you have injury, you release glutamate, and normally it'll just activate the output cells, goes to the brain, and there's your acute pain message. But when there's chronic injury, or in some cases, you produce an NMDA-mediated sensitization that now enhances the input that comes in through uninjured afferents, and you get an ongoing pain that's spontaneous, and that likely drives the burning pain, which is almost the hallmark of these conditions. So how would you treat this? I mean, it should be pretty easy. All you got to do is use an NMDA receptor antagonist. This little minor problem is that every neuron in the brain has the NMDA receptor, and so you have a slight side effect profile problem. The only thing that kind of works is ketamine, and if you want to talk about side effect profile problems, you have to start with ketamine. But literally, there's nothing better, and that's pretty bad news. So what does the clinician do? Well, the clinician takes advantage and tries everything. There are many more contributors. I don't have time to get into what all the different things that have been implicated, but there are also many different ways to treat. So let's just look at a few of them, and I'll summarize them. Here's a diagram that I borrowed from Howard Fields, and it just shows the afferent input of the spinal cord, the information of the brain. It also discusses and includes aspects of descending control, which is something that I cut my teeth on when I worked in London. So in addition to ketamine, which isn't even on here, topical local anesthetics, you want to shut off the drive. You could do sympathetic blocks, different nerve blocks. You might try transcutaneous stimulation or shake your hand as fast as you can. Spinal cord stimulation. Opioids, not very effective for these conditions. Cannabinoids, interesting question as to whether they're effective. California now will find out, because if you visit, you can use it. We're way ahead of what's happening in Washington. Uptake inhibitors, serotonin, norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, those are second line. And what is the first line, of course, are the gabapentinoids. So you have, why am I giving a lecture when there's so many different ways to treat this condition? I mean, it's a piece of cake for the clinicians. Well, here's the problem. Whoops. There we go. I forgot about even transcranial magnetic stimulation. Oh, and complementary medicine, which in the States is very big. I assume it's pretty big here. So there's so many ways to treat this condition. Well, the problem is that 30% effective in 30% of patients. That's a blockbuster drug. It's the gabapentinoids. In other words, 70% get basically no relief, and even when they get relief, the relief is minimal. So we have a big problem. So what I want to introduce is an approach that we've been taking that is pretty radical, but is really an approach to try to treat the condition, treat the disease, rather than symptomatic. And it really based on a kind of different, simple, simplistic view of the standard treatment paradigm, where you have nerve damage, you have nerve damage, and it produces neuropathic pain in a certain number of patients. And the treatment is, you try to treat the pain as a symptom. You want to sort of shut down the experience of pain somehow. The disease condition still exists, but you hope that this works. And obviously, it doesn't work very well, at least with what we now have. So the alternative, I would suggest, is the novel treatment paradigm should treat the pain as a disease, and then try to repair the disease. Because if you can repair the disease, maybe then you'll be able to reduce the pain. Makes sense. If you fix a broken bone, the patient will now have, or put a new hip in, you're kind of fixing the hip rather than trying to feed the patient lots of NSAIDs. Same idea. So how do we go about doing that? The idea is if the disease, what is the disease of neuropathic pain? I'll try to convince you that I believe that it's neuropathic pain is in many ways like epilepsy. In seizures, you have a loss of inhibitory control in the cortex, loss of GABAergic inhibition, patient has hyperexcitability, and it's manifest as seizures. And I think in many respects, neuropathic pain is a manifestation of loss of GABAergic control. And that's not a novel idea. So here's our diagram again, the afferent fiber, and all I've added now is some inhibitory, GABAergic inhibitory interneurons in yellow in the dorsal horn of the spinal cord. What we now know is that when there's nerve damage, there is I indicate here a loss of interneurons. That's controversial, but unquestionably there's a loss of inhibition. If you record from the output cells, you will find that the inhibitory controls of those cells is reduced. If you measure the enzyme that synthesizes GABA, the inhibitory neurotransmitter, namely GAD, it's reduced. And there's a whole variety of other pieces of evidence that unquestionably demonstrate there is loss of inhibition. So, this looks just like a cortex that's lost inhibition. How do you treat epilepsy? You treat it with an anticonvulsant. How do you treat neuropathic pain as first line with an anticonvulsant? And the pain goes up, and you try to reduce it by giving an anticonvulsant and gabapentinoids, which are lousy anticonvulsants, but they were developed as such. And pretty much any time a new anticonvulsant comes into the field, it's immediately tried in a patient with neuropathic pain because the recognition is they sometimes work. All right? Sometimes work. But the problem here, of course, is you take this drug, you might take it orally, you might take it systemically, I love telling the story. I gave a lecture to the public once, and I was talking about how NSAIDs work, and I said they block cyclooxygenase. When you have a joint that's inflamed, they prevent the synthesis of prostaglandin, so the NSAIDs block the COX enzyme, and that's how you resolve the problem. And a gentleman put his hand up and he said, "How does the aspirin know where to go?" And I said, "That's brilliant. The aspirin has absolutely no idea where to go. You just discovered why you have side effects." Well, if you inject any drug systemically, it's going to go wherever it wants to go, and it's going to get side effects. And that's why your therapeutic window is a problem. So maybe you can treat the problem by repairing a condition where the therapy is actually targeted in a circuit way rather than everywhere. And that's the approach we want to take. Can we instead treat the disease by actually replacing the inhibitory neurons that are compromised? And we do this by transplanting embryonic neurons and rebuilding circuits in the spinal cord. The story where it begins is interesting. My colleague, John Rubinstein, is a psychiatrist at UCSF, and he spends most of his time actually studying the development of cortical neurons. And he had demonstrated quite a few years ago that pretty much all of the, this is in the mouse brain, but it's the same in human, all of the GABAergic interneurons in the cerebral cortex come from an area of the forebrain, the embryonic forebrain, called the medial ganglionic eminence. The names aren't important. Nice population of cells that are clustered here, and they grow up They eventually, after they mitose, they post-mitotic, they develop GABAergic phenotype, and they will then fill up the entire cortex. This was the paper that caught my attention. What they did is they took a mouse in which the GAB enzyme was coupled to GFP so that the mouse, all the GABAergic cells would be green. So they took a mouse at about embryonic day 13.5 and took the cells out of the MG. These are progenitors. They're post-mitotic but progenitors. They haven't developed a GABA phenotype yet. And they transplanted them at that time into a neonatal mouse brain, a two-day-old mouse brain. And they let the animal grow up, and the cells not only developed into GABAergic interneurons with all the right properties, chemical properties, they spread around, they had properties just like GABAergic neurons. That was cool. But what was particularly striking to me and what got us interested is they then did an experiment where they took the cells and transplanted into a neonatal animal with a potassium channel defect. And that animal had a high propensity to have seizures. And they were able to significantly reduce the numbers of seizures. That caught my attention. Since I believe that neuropathic pain is an epileptic type condition, I went to John. It's kind of an interesting story. I went to John and I said, John, this is fabulous. It's a really cool study. We'd like to try it. Do you think it could work in the spinal cord? And he said, well, you can try anything. But I don't think it's going to work. Why? I said, well, a lot of reasons. Number one, these are GABAergic neurons destined for the cortex. They're not the GABAergic neurons for the cord, so it's the wrong cell source. We don't really have a population that I can pull out to get the spinal cord. Okay. The other thing is, we transplanted it into a neonatal animal. You want to transplant it into an adult animal that has a condition and then treat it, and it, probably the adult won't accept it. And the fact that it's the spinal cord is the wrong tissue. What else? His colleague said, Alan, even if they do survive, this is like E.T. come home, these guys. They are going to go from the spinal cord and they'll find their way back to the cortex. So with that enthusiastic encouragement, I went to a fellow in my lab, Joel Obraz, an absolutely brilliant neuroscientist now who's trained as a virologist. I didn't tell him everything John told me, and I said, I've got this great idea. And I said, guaranteed, they're very enthusiastic, and they think it's a great idea. And I wouldn't be here if it didn't work. So Joel tried that. And the first question was, can cortical, I emphasize, these are cortical cells, grow outside of the cortex? And so here's the model. Here's our spinal cord, here's our afferent fiber, some yellow cells that are the output cells, and I just threw in a lot of inhibitory interneurons. Of course, 80% of the cells there are actually excitatory interneurons. That's a different story. Today we talk inhibition. And what I said is that if you cut the peripheral nerve, and we can show this in animals, that you will lose the function or even lose some of the cells. So this is the starting point in an adult animal. And then what we injected was 50,000 MGE cells from a 13.5 embryo mouse. We ended up recovering, I will tell you, about 10% of those. We're not really sure where the rest went. We can talk about that later. But so this is what it looks like. This is what a transplant looks like one day. Remember, these are GFP expressing cells. So just to look at the outline, here's the gray matter, dorsal horn, here's the ventral horn. We're targeting the middle of the dorsal horn because that's where the sort of pain circuitry is, if you will. Here's white matter. This is one day. And this is what happens a month later. The cells leave this plug and they start to move. Now, they don't go to the cortex. They don't even go very far within the cord. They don't go deep into ventral horn. They stay pretty close. The odd cell will drop. We never see anything on the opposite side. So in contrast to cortex, they do fine. A single cell is pretty. This is what a single cell will look like a couple of months later. All right? The cells, and we only recover, I said, maybe 10% because we make 4 injections, but they are growing and they are happy campers. Are they actually neurons? They're not neurons when we transplant them, they're progenitors. That's an easy experiment. You take a transplanted spinal cord and you double label it with a neuronal marker. Many of you are familiar with Nu-N, it's an antibody against Nu-N. And you look for co-expression and you see all the yellow cells. the green cells are, 90% of them are yellow. They never turn into glia. They astrocytes, no microglia, no oligodendrocytes. So they're neurons. Are they GABAergic? Do they at least have a GABA phenotype? We'll come back to this. That's an easy experiment. Here's a high power image. You can see there's a few cells, lots of terminals. These guys are growing. Put an antibody to GABA on, and you will see that they're yellow. So the cells are making GABA at this point. Okay. So the question is, are they synaptically connected? And this is perhaps one of the most important messages I can leave you with. And it's been quite dramatic. I'm not a developmental biologist. And developmental biologists sit there and watch synapses grow, and they do an experiment. The next day, they have a paper. It's really impressive. But the kind of stuff I do takes a long time. What is fascinating or remarkable, what I'm going to try to convince you, is the synaptic plasticity, or the plasticity of the adult, in this case spinal cord, but we're now transplanting in brain as well. It is remarkably plastic, and I'll try to convince you. So are they, and why is this important? Because transplants have been done in humans, fetal transplants with NIDRA for Parkinson's. But one of the major questions has always been, are you actually rebuilding the circuit that's missing in the patient with Parkinson's, or are you just putting a very sophisticated cellular pump that's going to spit out dopamine, which is a nice source of a molecule that can help the individual? Well, we're interested in seeing if there's a circuit. And so the first question we took, and this is with Ida Llewellyn Smith, a colleague in Australia, who does the most exquisite ultrastructure that I know of in CNS, or certainly spinal cord. So this is now taking one of those treated animals, but staining for a marker. We're familiar with diaminobenzidine that gives a precipitate that we could take to the electron microscopic level. So this is this one's about 6 weeks after transplant. And you can see where the cells have migrated, and there's lots of processes. And I show this only because these are four cells, and if you know anything about GABAergic neurons in the cortex, this is what they look like. They don't look like spinal cord GABAergic neurons, and if you do the neurochemistry on them, they have the phenotype of cortical neurons. So these guys retain their cortical phenotype. They don't suddenly become spinal cord neurons, as far as we can tell. And take one cell and take this to the electron microscopic level and ask whether there's synapses formed. And the answer is yes. So the first thing I can show you is that the host talks to the transplant. This is a presynaptic terminal. There's lots of vesicles. It is presynaptic to a cell body that has the precipitate that defines the transplant. It's an antibody against the GFP. And so clearly, it's formed a synapse. Here's a beautiful example of a synaptic terminal, probably an afferent by its shape. You can see vesicles, mitochondria, and it is presynaptic to a dendrite from the transplant. And it's also presynaptic to dendrites from the host. Very characteristic of the dorsal horn type circuits. And in the other direction, here's a terminal coming from the transplant, an axon terminal. It has vesicles, and it's presynaptic to dendrites. And I show this at the bottom because this picture comes from a 6-month transplant. And there's an evolution of the synaptic circuitry that we're looking at. It's not that it makes a synapse. These things are changing, probably going in and out. The other thing I can tell you is these guys will synapse with anybody. We do not believe that they are recapitulating any circuit that existed previously. They just will inhibit anything or make contact with anything they need. All right? They'll even contact some of the host GABAergic neurons and vice versa. So they're integrated. Is it functional? This was an easy initial experiment. Many of you are probably familiar with the technique that uses FOS, immunocytochemistry, where you take an... It's a little fuzzy, but that's okay. So this is a transplant. 4 weeks after transplant, you can see the cell bodies. Some of this is actually artifact. And then what we did with this animal is stimulated with a noxious stimulus to the paw and used FOS immunocytochemistry to monitor population activity marker. It's just a protein that's induced in cells that are active. And this is what that looks like. All of the red dots are nuclei in neurons of the spinal cord that have been activated by the painful stimulus to the paw. The animal is killed 2 hours later, and now you double label and you say, are any of these cells, is FOS ever induced in some of the transplanted cells? And the answer is yes. Here's a good example. You can see a few green cells, And these guys are clearly have now a yellow nucleus because the red and green makes yellow. You have lots of FOS responses. So clearly some of the transplanted cells are now activated by a painful stimulus. They are clearly functionally engaged. And most recently, Alex Edlin, a postdoc in the lab, did the definitive experiment. And what he did is he asked in a slice preparation, and to be honest, this is not something we usually do in our lab, but the reviewer of the paper said if we don't do it, the paper won't be published. So we actually have to develop slice physiology, and it's not something I do, but Alex has been remarkable. This is, and the reason why I say this is because he's, in order to do these experiments, most spinal cord slice studies are done in a two, three-week-old animal. Spinal cord is a lousy preparation to do slices. He needs to do it in an adult because we have to wait till the animal is old enough to transplant them, then wait for at least 4 weeks for the transplant to grow, and then record. So this is an eight-week-old animal, and he's done others now. So you can see this, here's the green, it's not green, it's fluorescent. This is a slice of lumbar cord, taken, in this case, 3 weeks post-transplant. If you pass current after patching onto a cell, clearly fires action potentials. If you electrically stimulate the root, what you can see is you can drive the cell. So these are physiologically active, and then most recently, he did a really, I think, a really beautiful experiment, where what we did is we transplanted cells from an animal in which channel rhodopsin, through a Cre-dependent mechanism, was put into all of the transplanted cells. So we basically crossed a GABA-Cre line with a Cre-dependent channel rhodopsin animal. So now we can light stimulate all of the GABAergic neurons using optogenetics. And that's the experiment here. So the experiment is as follows. Now all the green cells are the transplanted cells, but they contain channel rhodopsin. So when you shine blue light, that will excite them. So instead of trying to do paired recordings and see if they're connected, you can turn on all the transplanted cells and record from the host, which is what he did, record from the host, and what you see is that when you stimulate, you induce iPSCs, inhibitory potentials. They are blocked by the GABA-A antagonist bicuculin. GABA-B antagonist did not do anything, and it's reversed when you wash. And if you go into current clamp, when you have spiking, turn a little blue light on, and you shut the cell off. It is absolutely clear that this is producing a GABA-A-mediated inhibition. And lastly, I don't want to show you, we transplanted, this was a tough reviewer, we transplanted from an animal in which VGAT, the vesicular transporter that stores GABA, so this is an animal that can make GABA but can't store it, so it'll never survive birth because it'll just seize all the time. But at 13.5, you take the cells, you transplant them into the cord, they survive, they don't do anything. The cells are there, but they don't help the animal at all. So it must have GABA. There may be something else coming out of the cells. We don't know, but GABA is absolutely necessary. And then, of course, finally, the most important question, if this is going to have any value from a pain perspective, is can we treat a model of neuropathic pain with this approach by rebuilding a GABAergic circuit? And the answer is yes. And this is the experiment. We took a model of CRPS. There are many of them in the mouse, in the rat, in the primate. In the case of the rodent sciatic nerve trifurcates. And what you do is you cut two of the three branches. We isolate the tibial, other people isolate the sural, whichever you want. The animal becomes incredibly mechanically hypersensitive 24 hours after doing that isolation. All right, we believe because it's compromised the normal inhibitory control in the spinal cord secondary to the injury. And the question then is, can, after inducing this hypersensitivity, and we test it with, you may be familiar with von Frey hairs, which are graded hairs used clinically just to measure thresholds. The animal will withdraw to a certain threshold, and when they're hypersensitive, they will withdraw with the slightest hair. And the question is, can the transplant do anything to reverse that? So here's the experiment. On the y-axis, we're just normalized threshold, so you could call it pain if you want. So pain is at a 100% normalized, and then this is, you know, baseline responsiveness. Then you injure. You have two groups going on here. One has a transplant of the MGE cells, another one is being transplanted either with medium or with dead cells. Their threshold plummets the next day, and this will last actually almost forever as far as we can tell. Then we transplant, and then we follow the animals and emphasize in a blind way, the person who's testing has no idea who got which transplant, etc. Follow the animal out, and by 4 weeks, the treated group is normalized. And we've now replicated this many times. And this is the control group, and they will stay. We have gone out at least 6 months, and this will do nothing, and this will last for a long period of time. We've never seen it return. So the conclusion is that this is not a pump, that this is a treatment that is disease modifying. Now, as I emphasize, it's not rebuilding the original circuit. What we believe is that it's creating a kind of gabastat. There's a level of inhibition that is sustained. In fact, what's most surprising is when we transplant before an injury, we can actually prevent the animal from becoming hypersensitive. Be an interesting prophylactic treatment for everybody. That's a joke. So, where do we go from here? Now, I come from California. In California, when you want to know where to go, you go to a psychic. My daughter sent me this slide that she found. It's really great. So you go to the psychic, because I'm not sure where we're going to go. And this one, but this is not one that I would go to. And the reason is, there was a psychic fair, apparently. It was canceled, but why was it canceled? Due to unforeseen circumstances. So, not the right person to ask for advice on where to go. So where do we go? Well, one of the things we've published now is not only nerve injury induced, traumatic nerve injury. We've done chemotherapy induced neuropathic pain conditions, and we can treat that. And that's a systemic condition produced by Taxol. Many patients have it. And the beauty there is we transplant on one side, and the animal is treated on one side and remains hypersensitive on the other side. That's both to cold, to heat, and to mechanical. So it's rather, it's topographic, localized. We've now done it in models of trigeminal neuralgia. They're not great models, but in other words, infraorbital nerve section, you can reverse the hypersensitivity in the trigeminal system. So it has potentially large targeting. What about chronic itch? Now, Irene mentioned this has become a real interest of mine. For a variety of reasons, itch is, people just think of it, it's not that interesting. There was a really incredible paper just published by Zhou-Feng Chen, familiar with the phenomenon of contagious itch, where, if I start scratching, there you go, somebody starts to scratch it. And it's a well-known phenomenon, and apparently he's replicated it in a mouse. The mouse looks in a mirror and sees another mouse scratching it. Whatever. But anyway, it's an interesting phenomenon, and it is a huge clinical phenomenon which people don't appreciate. It's a major unmet clinical need. And the next slide is kind of dramatic, but it was based on a patient that was described by Anne-Louise Oaklander, but it was written up in the New Yorker just to illustrate the problem. So this is a woman with postherpetic neuralgia, and we talked about postherpetic neuralgia. It's not the one I wanted to talk about. Neuralgia meaning pain, but the fact is 70% of these individuals who have a herpes zoster infection leading to postherpetic neuralgia actually have chronic itch. Very difficult to treat, and in many individuals, the itch will drive them crazier than the pain. It's oppressive. And it is illustrated dramatically in this paper written by Anne-Louise Oaklander, where she describes, I'm going to show you a rather harsh picture here. This is a real patient who had an itch condition, and she literally scratched through her own skull. And in reading the paper, this is from the paper, I just highlight a few things. This time, the area of the scalp that was involved became numb. We had an interesting discussion about numb this morning, and the pain was replaced by a constant, relentless itch. No matter how much she scratched, it would not go away. I felt like my inner self, like my brain itself, was itching. That's pretty powerful stuff. This is not typical, but it illustrates itch is a perception of the brain with a powerful emotional component. That's exactly what pain is. It's not a stimulus, it's a perception. So it's a very difficult thing, again, to appreciate. In this case, you can see somebody scratching. So what about models of itch, and can we do anything about this? Well, I was taken by a beautiful paper by Sarah Ross several years ago. She published a paper in Neuron, here's the title, and it was a BHLHD5, transcription factor required for the development of GABAergic neurons in the spinal cord, in the caudal part of the spinal cord. And she created a mutant mouse interested in development, but it turned out when the animals became about 6 to 8 weeks of age, they started to scratch, and it was oppressive. They never stopped scratching, and eventually she had to euthanize the animals. And basically, with the loss of GABAergic neurons, they postulated what makes a lot of sense, a very simple model that is very much like the pain model. In this case, you have not a nociceptor, but a proprioceptor that responds to itch-producing substances, chloroquine or serotonin. It drives interneurons and an itch pathway, and it's normally regulated by inhibitory interneurons, so you don't have, so you have normal itch, just like you have normal pain. But when in this particular mouse, where the inhibitory interneurons literally don't develop, you get too much output, the animal scratches. I saw this paper, I called Sarah, I said, Sarah, you know about our transplant work, we'd like to transplant your animals. So she sent some to us. I will tell you, they're very difficult animals to work with. They're not very healthy, but we did it. What I'm going to show you, it's published in JCI, so you can get all the details. But one animal where we followed the animal over time and compared them, of course, to a controlled transplanted animal. The animals develop the lesions in some place. Once they start to scratch, they don't go everywhere. They seem to focus on one place, and we targeted the transplant to the appropriate part of the spinal cord. Here's here's a mouse that started to scratch on the thigh persistently around 6 to 8 weeks. And then we transplanted and followed the animal 1 week, 2 weeks, 3, 4, 5 weeks. It healed because the animal stopped scratching. I called Sarah and I said, did you ever see an animal recover spontaneously? Never. They always have to be euthanized. And we had to euthanize the control animals. It will reverse it. It actually stops the scratching quite dramatically. We were pretty excited about this. So we would conclude at this point, I'm almost done, is that loss of inhibitory control contributes to both neuropathic pain and itch. Neuropathic in that it is produced by nerve damage, the loss of the inhibitory interneurons. The question then, neuropathic itch is not all that common, but non-neuropathic itch is extremely common. Atopic dermatitis, 2 to 3 million people in the States alone. I'm sure it's very prominent here, and very difficult to treat. These are not itch conditions that respond to antihistamines. It's not that simple. And so we were looking for, and now we've got several, but we were particularly interested in a model that was described many years ago. It's a model of atopic dermatitis. This is in a child, bilateral, and it's incessant itching, scratching, and the skin is very characteristic. This is normal skin where you have a thin epidermis and no infiltrate, but in the atopic skin, you get huge thickening of the epidermis, infiltrate, leukocytes, cytokine-releasing cells, called an acanthosis, I'm learning some of the language. So this is very characteristic, and then Stacy Dillon at Bristol-Myers Squibb, several years ago, developed a mouse, an interleukin-31 transgenic overexpressor. So this is a cytokine, interleukin-31, and in this case, it's being driven off of Th2 cells. It's produced by Th2 helper cells, so it's constantly being released into the skin. This particular molecule signals by the interleukin-31 receptor, which is expressed by a subpopulation of afferents, and the animals develop this condition. We got a hold of these mice with great difficulty and asked what happens if we transplant them. Can we use the transplants? And this is a case where there's no evidence of a loss of GABAergic interneurons or loss of GABA. What we did when we phenotyped them, there was a decrease of a GABA-B receptor in the cord. That's the only change we could find, which wasn't something we expected would help us. But it did. So here's one mouse. This just was published, came out about a month ago in JACI. This was bilateral scratching now in the neck. And I'll show you an animal that was treated, and I think you can tell which side was transplanted. Okay?
And just one other example, bilateral scratching, a little bit extended up to here, we transplant on one side, and you see what happens. It is really pretty remarkable, but what's really happening is not that it's healing, it's that the animal stops scratching. When they stop scratching, it has an opportunity, and it heals pretty quickly. And if we looked in the skin, you can see that. So here's the phenotype of an animal that scratched very thick epidermis, lots of infiltrate, and then you can see that the skin normalizes in these animals. So where do we go from here? And I'll end by telling you that our objective eventually is to see, can this be used at some point, take it to patients? And I will tell you, I'm on a scientific advisory board. I'm not part of a founder of a company that has started mainly to treat epilepsy, some of the group that began some of this early work. But we're interested in taking embryonic stem cells, human embryonic stem cells, that have been modified to become GABAergic neurons through kind of traditional approaches these days that were developed by several Japanese groups, and then see whether they could work. Nothing to tell you about iPS cells. I'll give you some of the preliminary results we have as embryonic stem cells. We transplanted into SCID mice. In other words, they have no immune system, otherwise they would reject the human cells. Transplanted, in this case, about 1 million cells, so starting point's completely different. Transplanted, and in this case, going into the spinal cord, it's being marked, STEM-121 is a stem cell marker that tells us where the cells are. We're looking for double cortin or Ki-67 markers of proliferation, which the biggest fear of this approach is that you'll develop tumors with these cells. We never did see any double cortin or Ki-67 staining, so that was encouraging. The cells move much more than MGE cells. They don't go to the brain or anything, but they'll go to the other side, they'll go to the white matter. So this is a different situation. Of course, it's being transplanted in a mouse, not in a human. Do they develop a GABA phenotype? Yes, this is now looking at 6 months. So this is now some stem cell positive cell bodies. You can see some terminals, and you put an antibody to GABA on, and we do see large numbers that actually are double labeled. So yes, they're making GABA. The question is, so what? And so we put them into our injury model, and the question is, can they do anything? And the answer is, well, yes, not as good, and it takes a long time. And this is a result that's not published. So here you just see control side. These are mechanical thresholds on the opposite side. They're obviously, they don't change from before or after the injury. You injure, and there's two groups. One that it has the medium or dead cells. This is medium. And this is the transplanted cells. So you get a significant recovery. It takes 2 months before we saw any change. And we got maybe a 50% recovery. Nowhere near as good as MGE cells on the mouse, but pretty encouraging. My colleagues who provided the cells to us, apparently the big problem is you cannot turn them into GABAergic neurons in vitro and then transplant them, they won't take. You have to transplant them, you have to wait a long, you feed them the goodies, transcription factors that direct their development, phenotypic development, transplant them, then you wait. And the trick then is to try to speed up that whole process. 6 months is a long time in the life of a mouse. That's about maybe a quarter of the life of a mouse. So if it does translate, then it would be pretty significant. So we're excited about the possibility of taking this at least this company, taking it to the human. It's not something we're involved in. But we are following this up now, going to cortex. As Irene knows, I spent my life studying pain, but only working in spinal cord. And there's no pain in the spinal cord. It's in the brain. And so we've now turned to the brain, and hopefully, and we can. I have a student who's, I don't know what's wrong with her, but she's just agreed to do a postdoc in Norway. No, I'm kidding. She's actually brilliant and has shown that the transplants will reduce pain phenotypes after transplant into rostral anterior cingulate cortex. We're pretty excited about that. And she's writing that up and we'll be starting a postdoc. That's Dina Juarez Salinas. That's where we are. And I would just say, in conclusion, I would say that there are many ways to treat neuropathic pain. I showed you them. There's whole lots of possibilities, and I'd like to suggest that treating the disease rather than symptomatically by trying to rebuild a broken circuit might be a possibility, and I would add transplants, and they could go in different places. These are the people who work in the lab, some have left already, but who did the work. Joao Braz, he's the fellow who did all the initial transplant work, really remarkable individual. Alex is a postdoc who did the electrophysiology. Xi Dao is in industry now, and with Dina, who did a lot of the behavioral work. It's Dina who's done cortical work and is moving to Norway to do a postdoc. Former postdoc Reza is at McGill, and Ida, who did all the electron microscopy, and my colleagues at the stem cell group who generate these cells to treat us. That's the story I wanted to tell. With your permission, I will end with what I typically end with medical students. It's just kind of fun. They're medical students here. I don't get the opportunity to do it with someone else. It started off as a lark many years ago that I started writing poems. I don't know why you told the story about the jokes, but never mind. I write poems for my lectures, and I'll just end by telling you one of my favorite. And it's called Praise the Lord for the Spinal Cord. Funiculi are the columns and fasciculi are the tracts, but it's at synapses and gray matter where interesting peptides interact. Now, nociceptive inputs enter the horns, and through neurochemical magic, the inputs are transformed. Lamina 1 is quite marginal, all can agree, and together with gelatinosa at lamina 2 contains substance P, enkephalin, dynorphin, and CGRP, providing continuous employment for a neuroscientist like me. Now, ventral to gelatinosa are lamina 3, 4, and 5. From here, many ascending pathways arise, transmitting nociceptive messages from the cord to the brain, where they may or may not be experienced as pain. You see, there are no pure pain pathways that access the brain, which is undoubtedly why anterolateral chordotomy for pain is on the wane. But since analgesic drug action peptide circuits explain, exploit cytochemistry, and perhaps someday transplants in the treatment of pain. For there are few in this audience who could readily afford to relinquish the functions performed by the cord. Sure, the brain is important, but the spinal cord central. So come, blow your horns, be they dorsal or ventral. And let us end by rephrasing the words of the Lord, honor thy mother, and don't cut the cord. Thank you.